Let's come and bring the reading to us now. It's from Deuteronomy chapter 10. We're reading from verse 12 through to verse 22. That's the end of the chapter.
And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to commit to keep the commandments and statutes of which the Lord, which I am commanding you today for your good. Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that is in it. Yet the Lord set his heart in love on your fathers and chose their offspring after them, you above all peoples, as you are this day. Circumcise, therefore, the foreskins of your heart and be no longer stubborn. For the Lord your God is God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty and the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him and hold fast to him, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise. He is your God, who has done for you these great and terrifying things that your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven.
As we look at this little section here, I keep saying this, but it's another one of these little chiasms. I've mentioned this before. It's a little trick that they have in the Hebrew literature. And what they do is they say something at the beginning of the text, at the beginning of a passage. They say something at the end, and then they say something else, and then at the end they say it. And they say these things, and eventually builds up to the middle. And in the middle point, this is the chiasm, this is the crux, this is the treasure map cross. This is the thing that is most important about this passage. And we've got this in the structure, and it's quite good because it helps us to see what it is that Moses would really like to take away from this message. But also what it does is, because you've got the same thing at the beginning and the end, you can see what's going through Moses' mind. So it helps us to understand exactly what he's saying in the other parts of the text. So if we think about our passage, at the very beginning, in the first part of verse 12, we have the question, what does God require of you? And at the end of verse 21 then, he is your God. What has he done for you? And the next thing he says in verse 12 and 13 is he said, God's asking that you fear him, you walk in his ways, you love and you serve him. So if you look at the end to verse 20, that's sort of repeated. Fear him, serve him, hold fast to him, honour his name. And then in verses 14 and 15, what we read is that the whole universe is his. And yet, he loved your fathers and chose you above all others. And then if we look at verses 7 to 19, he is God of gods, he is Lord of lords, and yet he cares for the most vulnerable and for strangers. And so the centre point, the thing that's the big focus of this message from Moses, is sort your hearts out. Verse 16, sort your hearts out and don't be stubborn any longer. So if we start to think about these, I'll read verses 12a and 21 and 22 together. I'll read from the NIV, because they've actually they've done it better, the translation of verse 12. So verse 12a, now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? And then verse 21, he is your praise, he is your God, who performed for you those great and awesome wonders you saw with your own eyes. Your forefathers, who went down into Egypt, were 70 in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. So I said that the NIV has translated this better. What does the Lord ask of you? It's some of the other translations it says require of you. That's probably a little bit too strong a word. It's definitely more of the question that the NIV does. What is the Lord asking of you? It's not a command. Not what is the Lord commanding you. And what Moses is doing, as we've seen so far, as we look through Deuteronomy, is he's stressing that This is a relationship that the Israelites have with their God. It's implied that there's an option for refusal, but why would you want to do it? And the idea is, if two people are working together, if there's a relationship there, then there are going to be reasonable responses from both parties as they move forward together. It's not all about one party calling all the shots. It's about the two working together. And so that's the question Moses asked: what is the Lord asking of you? If God is asking of you, and you're in this relationship with him, what has he done? What has he done that makes it worth you responding? And Moses tells him. He highlights the details here. Great and awesome wonders which you have seen with your own eyes. And the things that they've seen with their own eyes are 10 supernatural plagues in Egypt that won their release. What they've seen with their own eyes is this miraculous parting of the Red Sea to make dry ground for the Israelites to walk through and escape the pursuing armies of Egypt. What they saw is when the pursuing armies went down to that same seabed, saw God close the sea back over the pursuing armies and destroy them. What they saw with their own eyes were supernatural pillars of cloud by day and supernatural pillars of fire by night that constantly led the Israelites through on their journey. What they'd seen with their own eyes was miraculous appearances of food and water. Every morning they got up, and miraculously, in the middle of this desert wilderness, there was food just waiting to be picked up and consumed without fail. And where there was nothing but dry and barren rocks, and they were convinced they were going to die of thirst, then what they saw is they saw the rocks split open and water gush out of it. What they saw is that when they were bitten by deadly snakes and they were dying in their droves, they looked up and they saw a serpent on a pole that God had been told to put on a pole. They looked up and miraculously they were healed, saved from death. What they'd seen, they saw the same things as their fathers had seen before them as they approached the land. They saw demonic giants, huge soldiers armed for battle. And what they'd seen is these giants defeated, wiped out, utterly crushed. They'd seen all of these things with their own eyes. What has God done for them that deserves any such response? What he also does is he speaks there at the end of our section. The Israelites are here. They're about to enter into a land which had been promised to them. It had been promised to their father, Abraham, the father of the nation, had been promised to him, and it was carried through. It had been promised to Abraham, now around about 400 years before. God had said, he's got his own timing for these things, but that promise was made nonetheless, that they would be given a land. There was also a second promise made to Abraham, not just that they would inherit the land, but what he said to Abraham, this is in Genesis 15, verse 5, what he said, God promised to Abraham, he said, because Abraham at the time was worried, he hadn't got any children, and God had promised him he was going to have lots of children. He hadn't got any children. So God says, go outside, look up at the heavens, and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said, so shall your offspring be. That's what God had promised in the past to Abraham. That was the first promise. And Abraham's also promised the land. And what Moses points out to them there, he says, look, 70 of Abraham's descendants went into Egypt. 70 of them. Joseph, which the ladies I talked about yesterday, was the first one. 69 others from the family followed him into Egypt. And despite Egypt's attempts at genocide, trying to wipe out Israel, trying to kill the babies, trying to work them to death, what happened during that time in Egypt? God had kept his promise to Abraham. And now, as they stood on the border of the promised land, they look up at the stars in the sky, and they were as numerous as the stars in the sky. So many of them. God had kept his promises. This was their God. This was the one who was asking them to respond in like manner. He was in a relationship with them. God was delivering on his side. What was he asking of them? Just that they deliver on their side, that they play their part in this relationship. And so we come to the nub of it, the second half of verse 12. This is what God's asking in real practical terms, Moses is saying. What is God asking? That you fear the Lord your God, that you walk in all his ways, that you love him and you serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and you observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I'm giving you today for your own good. And verse 20, fear the Lord your God and serve him. Hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. What Moses is doing in this passage here is making it clear that God is not actually asking anything costly from them. In fact, it's actually quite the opposite. In verse 13, what Moses is saying is that everything God is asking them to do is actually for their own good. It's for their own benefit. It's not actually costly to them. There's no net negative effect. And what we can do is we can think about what Moses is leaving out of this passage here. They're asking, what does their God want? And what is, you just look at this passage, he's not asking for great sacrifices in this passage. He's not asking for some great religious system. That's not what God's really after. He's not asking for temples. He's not asking for elaborate rituals. None of those things are mentioned in this passage at all. That's not what God is after. What he's after is that they fear the Lord and that they walk in his ways. They love him and they serve him. That they hold fast to him. That they take oaths in his name. And as we think about what's being asked there then, the first thing I'd want you to notice as you look at the second half of verse 12 is when it says to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul, it means with all of you, everything about your being, all of your emotions and all of your actions, the things you feel, the things you do. So just to be clear on that, fear and love, which Moses is saying God is asking, they're both emotions. Whereas walking and serving and holding fast and honouring, they're all the practical outworkings of those emotions. So he's not wanting just fuzzy feelings inside you, but he's wanting you to actually live your life as though you were one of God's people. That's what he's asking. Christianity, for us in this age, is not just something you believe, but it's a way of life. It's how you live, it's what you do, it's how you think, it's how you act. You know, James picks up on this a few times in his letter, so worth sitting down and reading in chapter 2, verses 22 to 26. He says, faith and actions, they work together. Faith, belief, is made complete by what you do. Faith without work, faith without any actions, is dead faith. And in James 4:17, anyone who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it, sins. So that's the first thing we see. It's everything about us, the way that we feel, the way that we act, everything about us needs to be given over to him. The second thing we see, because it's listed first by Moses at both the beginning and the end of our section, it might seem strange that what God asks from us is that we fear him. And it always seems a little bit of a confusing thing, and I spent a whole sermon explaining what that meant. The fear of the Lord, and if you want to find it and you want a better explanation of it, it's in Job chapter 28 part 3 in that list of sermons, and that goes into like the full explanation of what it means to fear the Lord. But as a brief summary for us today, I put it this way: to fear the Lord does mean be frightened of him. It does mean be frightened of him, because God is terrifying. But for those that believe, and I think this is the best explanation of it, for those that believe, it's a little bit like going to a fun fair to go on one of the roller coaster rides, or Nemesis ride, or whatever the latest craze is, one of those rides there. That when you go to one of those rides, and when you're on one of those rides, it's terrifying. You're in fear for your life. But because we know it's safe, what happens is that fear doesn't become a negative thing or a bad thing, but what it does, it becomes thrilling and exciting. And you scream because it's just this contrary emotions that are going on. It uplifts you, it builds you up, you come off and you just can't help but talk. And that's the sort of fear that we have of God. He is terrifying, but we know we're secure in his presence. And so the ride is just exciting and thrilling. So that's the best explanation I can give for you. But I say you can go and listen to Job 28 if you want to try and get a better idea of it. The other unusual thing that Moses says in this passage is he tells us to take oaths in God's name. And I mentioned when we were in chapter 6 that Jesus, when he gave his Sermon on the Mount, which is in Matthew chapter 5, what Jesus told is don't take oaths in God's name. What Jesus says is what you should do as a Christian, just keep your word. Let your yes be yes, let your no be no. You don't swear on God at all because it shouldn't be necessary. And so what we can see is there's a cultural practice, there's a context for Moses when he's telling to give oaths in the name. And what was happening is in their culture and in their time, what you would do is if you wanted to swear on something, then you would swear on the highest name or the highest authority, the highest thing that you would know. And effectively, in doing that, you're giving honour. You're saying that this thing I'm swearing on is higher than any other. And so Moses says, swear in God's name, because that's putting him up there in the highest name. But that's not a permanent instruction for us to give our oaths and swear on God's name, because Jesus said, no. It shouldn't be necessary for the people of God to make any oaths or to do any swearing at all. Just keep your word. Let your yes be yes, let your no be no, and let people know that. They see by your behaviour that that's the way you live. The next little section, verse 14 and 15, what we're told is this, and this becomes really quite striking as we start to think about it. Verse 14 and 15, to the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. And yet, the Lord set his love, set his affections on your forefathers and loved them. And he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations as it is today. And verse 17, the Lord your God is God of gods. He is Lord of lords. The great God, mighty and awesome, shows no partiality, takes no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the alien, the stranger, the sojourner, giving food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were once aliens in Egypt. What Moses does here is he brings home to them just how privileged these people are. Verse 14, the God of the universe, the one who owns the heavens, not just the sky and the birds and the planets and the stars, not just those, but the highest heaven, the heaven of heavens. And if you actually looked up in Nehemiah 9, verse 6, we're told that the highest heavens, the heaven of heavens, that's where all the angels, that's where all the spiritual beings, that's where the hosts live, in this spiritual realm above the heavens. So not only does God own the skies, not only does he own all the earth and the oceans and everything within them, but he owns all of the spiritual beings and the heaven beyond it. All of the universe was his. All of it was glorious. All of it was good. And what did he do to be his special possession? He chose one man, Abraham, and said, I'm going to make you into a nation. He chose these people of Israel. Out of all the mighty angels, he chose Israel. Out of all the glorious things in creation, he chose mankind. He chose to set his love upon us. He is God of gods. He is Lord of lords, says 17. He's mighty and awesome. And what does this unbelievably powerful God do? He doesn't surround himself with the rich and the powerful and the great. Instead, he reaches down in his power and his might and his authority to those with no protector. And he is their protector. He reaches down to the fatherless. He reaches down to the widow. He reaches down to the homeless stranger. And he feeds and he clothes them. This is what our great and mighty God do. This is Israel. This is what he did to you, for you in Egypt. When you were homeless strangers in Egypt. When you were weak. When you didn't have a protector. God protected them. And all God asks of us, what does he ask of you? is that we do for others what he has already done for us. The things we've experienced, that we've seen with our eyes, that we know to be true, that we know of him. And this is echoed in Jesus' words. John 13, 34, and John 15, verse 12. Jesus' words are, love one another because I have loved you. You're just doing what I've already done. 1 John 4, 11, and verse 19. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. We love because he first loved us. What does God ask of you? Verse 21, I know. He asks you that you do what he's already done for you. You keep your promises, you demonstrate your love, you act in ways that he acts. Well, we're told in Deuteronomy 4, when we looked at that passage, verse 6 and 8, the Israelites were being given all these laws and given all these rules. So, not so that they would be right with God, that wasn't the purpose of it. What happened in Deuteronomy 4, 6 to 8, God says, he's given these laws so that the world will know that they are God's people. What would happen is the world would look onto this nation of Israel and see the way they behaved. They would recognize the people of Israel as being wise and understanding. They'd look on the people of Israel and recognize them as a people being blessed by God. They would look on Israel, the small, insignificant nation, who'd now grown to be great under God's hand and by following God's laws and God's rules. And Jesus says exactly the same thing, John 13, 35. This is how the world will know that you are my disciples, if you have loved one another, if you love as I have loved you. This is how you'll know. He's not asking anything unreasonable in this relationship. So what happens if we start to think about this? All that God is, all that God has done, all that God will do, because you know he will do it, because he's already shown you he keeps his promises. Israel, what do you need to do? Verse 16. Now you know these things, circumcise your hearts. Do not be stiff-necked any longer. Transform those hard hearts inside you. Stop being stubborn. Why are you behaving the way you're behaving when you know what God is like, when you are his people? Now, what's really striking here, and is Moses' use of this phrase, circumcise your hearts. Because none of these people here, none of this next generation, none of them were actually circumcised. They've been given the instruction to be circumcised, which marked them out as being part of the people of God. But what we're told in Joshua 5, which is when they actually went into the promised land, in Joshua 5, we're told that none of those born after they left Egypt had been physically circumcised. And yet here, Moses is speaking to them about circumcising their hearts when they hadn't even circumcised the body yet. And so what we can do when we think about this is we start to see that what is being asked of people, what is being asked of the people of God, it's not about Jewish religious practice. Moses didn't say, go and get circumcised first and then circumcise your hearts. He goes straight to the heart. It's not about law and it's not about rules. It's about how to live godly lives. Romans 2 just confirms that for us in the New Testament. Romans 2, 28. A man is not a Jew if he is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly. And circumcision is circumcision of the heart and by the Spirit, not by the written code. So what Moses has already shown here, even before they've started out in this nation, marking themselves as people of God, that it's actually about something much bigger than that. It's something about the work of the Spirit. And so as we look at this here, it seems, you might look at it and you might think Moses has given a command and saying, you know, go out and circumcise your hearts, deal with your hearts, get them right before God. That's what you need to do as part of your religious practice. But we know that it's not. Because if we actually get to the end of the Deuteronomy, chapter 30 and verse 6, what Moses does is he shows that this circumcision of the heart, the transformation of the heart, is something that man cannot do himself. You can't go out and circumcise your heart. There's nothing that you can do with your will and your determination in your mind to actually do it right. Well, it says in Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, he said, the Lord your God will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your descendants, so that they may then love him with all their hearts and with all their souls and live. What needs to happen is it needs to be a work of God. And how is God going to do this? What was Moses talking about? What was he seeing as he wrote those words at the end of Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 6? What Moses was looking to was recognizing there would be a work of God that he would do. And the one that Moses looked forward to, though he didn't know who he was yet, was the Lord Jesus Christ. Colossians 2, verse 11 tells us this. In Jesus, you were also circumcised. In putting off the old sinful nature, not with a circumcision done by the hands of men, but with a circumcision done by Christ. And Paul warns us, Philippians 3 verse 2, he says, anybody that's telling you that you need to do something, or it's practical deeds or something like that, don't listen to those. Philippians 3 2. Watch out for those dogs, those men who do evil, those mutilators of the flesh. For it is we who are the circumcision, we who worship by the Spirit of God. It's nothing to do with outward flesh cutting or any work of your own, but it's something that the Spirit works at and does in us. And so just practically, just answer that question nearly at the end here. What does it mean to circumcise the heart? What is supposed to be being cut off? And I will give you a few explanations. I'll quote some verses here for you. Ephesians 4, 22. Your former way of life. Put off the old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, and be made new in the attitude of your minds, and put on your new self, which is created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. We're putting off all that went before of our old selves as we take on the Lord Jesus Christ, and we become the image of God, what God created, and we become like him. We behave like him. That's what he asks of us. We just do what he's already done. In Colossians 3, verse 7, you used to walk in these ways, in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourself of all the such things as these, of anger and rage and malice and slander and filthy language from your lips. Don't lie to each other, since you've taken off your old self with its practices, and you've put on your new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of the Creator. We've been transformed into his image. And it continues in Colossians 3, verse 11. There is no circumcised or uncircumcised. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly beloved, clothe yourselves with compassion, with kindness, with humility, with gentleness and patience. Bear with each other. Forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. He is our God. God of God, Lord of lords. The heavens are his, the earth is his, and all that's in them. The highest heavens are his, with all the spiritual beings, all the archangels and the seraphim and the cherubim, all that great host in heaven, and yet he chose you and set his love upon you. And what does he ask of you? To complete the work he's already done, which he himself is working on, transforming you into the image of himself, the image of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. We love because he loved us. We serve because he served. We walk because he walks beside us. He walked before us. He leads the way. He doesn't ask us of anything that's going to be for our harm. All things work together for our good. Amen.